Morning, everyone. It is Friday, December 1, 2023, and I am Ray Hanania here at Radio Bellady on WNZK AM 690 Radio. I host the program here every second Friday of the month, but this is a special edition of the radio show today. I also host a special season of 26 radio programs sponsored by Arab News at arabnews.com. We're in the off season right now, so I'm happy to sit in as a guest host on Layla El Husseini's important WNZK AM 690 U.S. radio network. Today, we're going to talk with Hani El Madhoun, who experienced firsthand the war crimes and killings of civilians by Israel's government. I also hope you will read my columns and news reports about all this at arabnews.com and also at hanania.com, which is the hub for all of my writings. All 14-year-old Sawar El Madhoun wanted to do was play basketball. Her 9-year-old brother Omar dreamed of being a soccer star. Their dreams died with them in the early hours of Friday, November 24, when as they slept, Israeli forces dropped massive bombs supplied by the United States of America on their home in Beit Lahia in the Gaza Strip. Their parents, Majid, 41, and Safa, 38, were also killed in the indiscriminate Israeli slaughter, along with their siblings, Rahman, 18, who had just started college, and 7-year-old Ali, said Hani El Madhoun in the interview. Hani is Majid's brother. Hani is an American citizen who works for the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East offices in Washington, D.C., UNRWA-USA. He supervises charitable fundraising efforts to help needy families. Only two of his brother's children, daughters Roa and Salam, survived the carnage. They are married and live with their families in Gaza in Rafah. The future of his family is in terrible jeopardy, and we don't know what's happening to them or thousands of other Palestinians. 15,000 have been killed, and some 100,000 have been injured. In fact, Safa, who died, the wife of Hani's brother, her entire family of 12 people were massacred and killed by, again, American U.S. 2,000-pound bombs supplied to Israel that were dropped in Gaza during the first 2 weeks of the war, weeks before Majid and Safa were killed with their children. Please check out my columns at hanania.com and how words are used as weapons in the Israel-Gaza conflict. What Hamas did on October 7th was absolutely wrong and horrendous. There was no justification for the intentional killing and torture of civilians. But Israel's government is doing today in Gaza absolutely the same thing. It is no different than what Hamas did. The only difference is that Israel's government does it nearly every day, killing civilians and brutalizing innocent civilians. Again, go to hanania.com to read my columns on the abuse of the terms, for example, hostage versus prisoners. More than half of the so-called Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are not prisoners at all, but they are hostages illegally incarcerated as a means of bullying the civilian Palestinian population under ancient laws imposed by the British government to thwart Jewish and Arab activism in Palestine in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s. Most Palestinians have been incarcerated by Israel under the terms of that illegal system called administrative detention, and they are never officially charged with a crime because they never committed a crime. They're jailed for up to 6 months at a time, indefinitely renewed in many cases for as long as 10 years or more. What we are seeing really is an exchange of hostages today, hostage for hostage. But the biased and racist mainstream American news media and the racist American political system want you to believe that only Israelis are hostages and that all Palestinians, including women and young children, are prisoners or, in their words, terrorists. We're broadcasting live on WNZK AM 690 radio and streaming on the U.S. Arab Radio Network at facebook.com/U.S. Arab Radio. Make sure to check out my columns again and news stories at arabnews.com and at hananiyah.com. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have our interview with Hani El-Madhoun, who is a UN Relief and Works Agency fundraiser who helps raise money for needy people in the Middle East. And we'll share his tragic story, because the pain that Palestinians are suffering, the massacres of women and children and old people, all civilians, need to be told. This is just one story of thousands that are taking place today in the Gaza Strip. I'm Ray Hanania. We will be right back right after these messages. This is Ray Hanania with Arab News newspaper, and I'm interviewing Hani El-Madhoun. He is the director of philanthropy for the UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, USA, UNRWA USA. And they do so much good, but we're really talking with Hani because I thought it was so important that what he has gone through, he and his family, as individuals, not with UNRWA, but as an individual, what is he and his family have gone through needs to be shared with the public. They need to understand what is actually happening in the Gaza. And Hani, I know that you, from my understanding, was you were born in the Emirates, but because your family was there, correct? But you're Palestinian.
Yeah, so my dad left for the Emirates for a job for a few years, and I was born there. We came back after the first Gulf War to Gaza, where I spent my formative years during the first Intifada.
So your father lived under the occupation then, was that it?
Yeah, he lived through the heartbreak of 67, and you know, he was going through the Sinai Desert to go to his college in the Red Cross buses, and it's just somehow the history did not change very much.
Right. And then he goes to get work, goes to the Emirates, finds work. You're born there. Your family. Tell me a little bit about your family, too, including your brother, who unfortunately was deceased as a result of this conflict. But tell me about your family so the public knows, you know, your family and where they're from and what kind of people are they?
Great. Well, thank you for having me, Ray. You're somebody I respect because you work, you know, behind the microphone. A lot of people, you know, it's not an easy job. It's not an easy field. But thank you for having me. I wish it was better circumstances. So I am a Palestinian American. I'm a child of an educator. My dad is a teacher for the longest time. He taught. He was a teacher in four different countries. He loves teaching. We have a Sometimes you think having a big family is a blessing, but during the conflict like that in Gaza, it's not really a conflict, it's a war. It's my personal genocide, as we will know later. But it's worrisome because you have to check up on everybody and then figure out how you can support those folks. And it's unfortunately, Ray, a lot of responsibilities, a lot of heartache, a lot of needs, emotional ones, a lot of need for support. But also, you know, you're here, you can't do much. You've seen how the government treats our cause. You know, we're getting shot here and in Vermont and in Chicago, as you know. So it's heartbreaking. Where I've got the fortune to go to a Mormon university in Utah. That's why I came to the BYU on a scholarship. That's how I got to this country. Got my scholarship, got my education, did an internship. One job leads to another. You know, my first internship was with ADC, your old friends at the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Then moved on doing fundraising. First job out of college was, hey, can you do bookkeeping? I did that, and then I transitioned into membership and fundraising. And I have a family here. We live in Annandale, Virginia, where we're fine physically, unharmed, but you know, the scars from watching our family and talking to them is just heartbreaking.
Tell me a little bit about your family prior to Gaza, what happened this month. The past 7 weeks, but like you said, you were born in the Emirates, and then eventually you moved, the family, including you, you moved to Gaza. Was that correct?
We moved to Gaza for for, you know, a year before my dad joined us. He was looking for a job in Gaza. He had a decent job in Dubai, but my sisters got older, so my dad did not want them to marry and move on to different countries. So he said, send him home. He can marry someone from the family. And that's what they did. And then a year later, he came once to visit us, took the employment job for UNRWA, actually, and he didn't think much of it. And then they called him a year later, hey, we need you to come back. We have a job for you. They offered him a living wage. And remember, we're Palestinian refugees. So he came back and the family became one again. Where, you know, then they started a small business, selling kitchenware stuff, appliances, gifts, and knickknacks. We really built a very successful business and loved being there with the family, being involved. Obviously, we've attended the years of Oslo. There was some hope then. Then that was all erased in 2000. And you have the rest of the story.
And was your father originally from Gaza or the West Bank?
No. Good question. We're actually from a town called Ashkelon. That's Ashkelon in Hebrew.
Sure.
It's the nearest town to Gaza, the nearest big city. And historically, this town is very historic. You know, it even predates Gaza. It used to be, when you talk about the Gaza district, it used to cover all the way to Ashkelon. So now Gaza is only a smaller piece of what it used to be once. And now it seems the Israelis may shrink it even more. I hope that doesn't happen, but we'll see what they can get away with this time.
And tell me about your brothers and sisters first, before we talk about what happened to them. I mean, tell me about your family. So your father and your mother
Yeah, my mom is a homemaker. My siblings all went to school. Some went to colleges. Most of them found success in business, so, you know, and forming families. So that was really the beauty about being in Gaza, because you're near family, but also you could do business and you have the family support. My dad loved teaching, but he also, you know, he was a good dad. He's a prankster. He would buy us things, leave them in the car and tell us, sorry, I didn't bring that Game Boy for you. And then go lock the car, it's there. So we loved that about him.
He had a good sense of humor.
He did. Like the bikes he got for us, and he's the best. And my mom is the greatest, obviously. So, you know, she even tried to talk me out of coming to America because she loves me so much. Now she wishes she sent more people away from Gaza to be safe.
She wanted you to stay in the Gaza area?
Yeah, she told me, like, hey, why don't you stay with us, finish your college? Because I had started a local college for a two semesters. Hey, find the girl, get married, and then stay with us. That was in 2000, as she dropped me off at the Erez crossing. And I said, no, I'm meant to be there. So, you know, one thing leads you to another. You're in the shadow of Washington, D.C., trying to give voice to your people as much as you can.
Now, and are your parents still with us? Or are they still?
Yes, they're good with us. They are wishing to be dead right now, but they are alive. And unfortunately, we'll get to that in a minute.
Tell us what happened to the family, because in social media, I've seen your family is very large. There are a lot of people. It's a big family that you come from. How many brothers and sisters? How many grandkids and uncles?
If we talk about extended family, our family might be 5% of the population in Gaza. So this is anybody with the same last name as my name. Might be even 10% if we count our in-laws. Now, this is a very big family, the biggest in Gaza. But my immediate family, you know, it's, you know, we're four boys and five girls. And I have a sister, she's in Sweden, another sister in Egypt. So that's the number right now in Gaza as we speak. I have three sisters and used to have three brothers, but now there are two brothers. And that's before October 7th. October 7th happened. Now the family is shrinking. And that just hit me. I didn't think about that.
How many people, tell us what happened to some of your family members. Annie, I know this is tough, but I think it's so important for people to know what Palestinians are going through. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, so I just came back from Gaza about 3 months ago. In August, we left Gaza. We had the time of our lives. Our girls loved being in Gaza. Obviously, before October 7th, there was a lot of issues with poverty and unemployment and movement. You know, we left Gaza, and I prayed to God that this is the last time I have to deal with the Rafah crossings. Because, Ray, if you remember, our biggest fight was visa waiver program. And then all of a sudden, we're not talking about that anymore. So a week into the war on Gaza, the Sinai conflict, the Sinai military campaign, it's a full-blown war against the defenseless Palestinians. What happened is we've lost 14 family members. They're not close to us, but physically they live not too far from us. I did not know these people. I feel sad for their loss and their family. Obviously, that was hard. A week
that
later,
that was your sister. That was your sister-in-law.
Actually, no, before my sister-in-law. Then a week later, my sister-in-law, Safa, she lost all her family, 12 family members in one attack, gone. They don't exist. Mom, dad, 5 siblings, spouses, kids. And it was so bad. Like, we knew these people, and we're like, crap, they're deep.
Where were they living?
They lived in that Twam area. It's in the north Gaza. So that's an intersection where before you leave the Jabalia area, you go to Gaza City. And like that, and, you know, family, the good volunteers in the family went, dug up the body. It was so horrific, the scene and the genocide at their home, that they wouldn't let Safa see her family because of the brutality of the body parts and flown pieces and missing pieces, plastic bags. So my brother, Majid, went, her husband, collected the bodies, buried them. And, you know, there is no proper burial because we know, like, there is crowds. And honestly, Gaza is running out of spaces now for graves, from what I'm reading about those reports. And cemeteries are overflowing with dead bodies. And, you know, remember, in most cases, these people are burying their dead under bombs. And now there is more snipers and more. And guess what? There is no fuel, very little fuel for the common person. So that creates a number of problems. And now we have the no communications. How would you tell somebody this is a real case? Now, fast forward to Friday, this Friday, November, Black Friday. Somebody wakes me up around 3:30 a.m. My nephew Ahmed calls me from Greece. He's had read the news that my brother got killed with his family. And he was crying on the phone. It was 3:30 a.m. That's my brother, Majid. We're very close. He's my buddy. We used to have this sibling rivalries, but, you know, who's ever going to do the best for their parents, their family? He would usually send me his GPS location so I could keep tabs on him. And now, you know, he doesn't have to do any of that. So I learned that he was killed with all his family. So that's Majid, his wife, Safa. Remember, Safa already lost all her family members. Then his two girls, Riman, 18 years old, Siwar, she's 13, going in 14, Siwar. And then the two boys, Omar, who's 9, and Ali, who's 7. So that's, I think, 10. So we're like, process this. You hear the news with your ear, Ray, but you don't know if you're hearing it or you might. I swear, my heart was racing like, this is it. This is the nightmare you've been waiting for. And it took me a minute to process. And I was like, crap, what's going on? And I couldn't find any news about it because, you know, we read Telegram and all that, the news, and it's not coming up. I thought maybe there's a mistake, but he did confirm to me. And then minutes later, my sister in Sweden calls up. Remember, nobody in Gaza can communicate. So we're not knowing the people in the ground. We're knowing from, because the journalist has access to internet and we read it. And it was insane. This is the house where everybody was sheltering in for the last 40 days or so. And it was, he was killed 2 hours to an hour and a half before the truce. And remember, the truce was delayed. Had they honored that first thing, he would have not been killed. And the whole building, 5 stories, collapsed in this fashion. And this became like everybody's trapped under. And they kept digging. The only body that was found immediately is Omar. He flew from the window to the street 20 meters away. And we were able to bury him. Now, hold on with me. So they want to find Majid. And my mom knew her son is dead. She's grieving. And then on top of that, no ambulances, no bulldozers are able to come to like, hey, can we remove this rubble? There is only one working machine in Gaza, right, in northern Gaza, and they're not willing to come. They even offered 10 times the price. They wouldn't come because they fear for their, you know, vehicle will be destroyed by the military, the Israeli military, that is. So she's crying because she knew about these stray dogs that have been munching on people's flesh, and she doesn't want her body, her son's body, to be desecrated. And that's just really unfortunate because she's already struggling. They're already thirsty. There is very little food in the north. And how do you deal with that? And your mom is calling you. She's desperate. She's heartbroken. Nobody's coming to the rescue. You know, I've had meetings as high as the White House with names you know and names you don't know and State Department, all these guys. And I can't get safety to my family. It broke me. And, you know, we all love our moms and dads, but that's just, you know, a lady that's her son is bare. She can't even have a minute with him. She can't even take a picture to keep because his body, his face is swollen. And, you know, so what happened is they kept digging with shovels. 2 days later or a day later, they recovered his body. And then 3 days later, they couldn't get anything. And then my brother thought, hey, they smelled a stench of death, right? And then they figured out the bodies actually of most of my family flew to a building next door, and they broke the wall. The house is empty, evacuated. So they broke the wall and recovered the bodies in a bad shape. They recovered 2.5 bodies, not 3 bodies. There is still remain 1.5 bodies that are accounted for. Poor Siwar, the basketball player, the 14-year-old girl, she loves basketball, really the salt of this earth, a very sweet girl. She was killed. She did nothing. She was asleep, just like all her family. And half of her mom, only one half was recovered.
Aye.
Riman was recovered, Ali was recovered. And here's another thing, like if you think a human Palestinian life doesn't matter, our their own cat was buried and killed next to them. We adopted a cat named Lucky, a very misfortunate name. They like to call her Cece. She was killed between the two kids because they loved to play with her so much. And my mom takes solace that my brother was killed at 5 a.m. around Fajr time. So he was, you know, at the time doing his Friday prayer. Sorry, it's Friday, Fajr prayer on Friday. So it's a lot. It's what do we deal with it? You feel helpless. Like, you know, we could ship weapons to Israel in an hour, but we can't get a sip of water for my mom. And this is just speaking as a Palestinian American with a family in Gaza. I'm not speaking as the official capacity because, you know, there is heartbreak. You know, this is personal. It used to be like, oh, I'm sorry. I really feel bad for the victims. Now it's personal because they came for my family and I know my family. There is no way in heck you could build a case like, hey, why would they kill Majid? Majid used to run to his store. He had a little bike, goes. He's the first to do good. Like whenever I have like extra money, I send it to him. He adds, I give him $500 to buy food for people. He spends $550. He's that kind of person. Loved his mom, honored his parents. And he's killed, and we don't know why. You know, I don't know. We're processing this, right? And it's just so fresh. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. So between October 7th and November 24th, Majid's wife's family, Safa, loses 14 family members. Then on the Friday, November 24th, early in the morning, they're in their building, which I think you said was what, 5 stories? They have an apartment in the building, right?
In fact, so here's the building. I own an apartment in that building. So partially it's a family house. Majid owns the most of it. And they bank.
So the whole building. Whole building is your family's building.
And what makes it worse, yes, it's between me and Majid, we own the building, and right. I have an empty apartment that's, you know, I don't use, but it's just because everybody worked hard in the shop. My dad gave us each a unit. But to be honest, Ray, this is, with the human loss is too great. You cannot replace it. We could say we were rebuilt despite the fact that we're looking at hundreds, tens of maybe $150,000, $200,000 loss. And on top of that, my dad's food, he has a little grocery store, was also bombed. He was keeping it safe because he thought somebody would break into his store. All that cooking oil and grains are destroyed. And their savings are also under the rubble because they felt magically they're in the move because they don't have a house. The Israelis already bombed one house for us. Now they bombed the second one. And my family is homeless. And we're not like that. And it's just becomes, and remember the refugees from 48.
So we're going to take a quick break here at Radio Ballady at WNZK AM 690. And when we come back, we'll continue the radio show. I'm Ray Hanania. We'll be right back right after these messages.
This is Ray Hanania with Arab News newspaper, and I'm interviewing Hani Elmedhoun. He is the director of philanthropy for the UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, USA, UNRWA USA. And they do so much good, but we're really talking with Hani because I thought it was so important that what he has gone through, he and his family, as individuals, not with UNRWA, but as an individual, what is he and his family have gone through needs to be shared with the public. They need to understand what is actually happening in the Gaza. So your father, Omar, had a grocery store in another building then and nearby.
Just a 3-minute walk, actually. The
very close to it.
Yeah, and he used to save his stuff because he feared somebody would loot it. Because
right,
it's
of course.
Very end of civilization.
So that was his life. That was his job. He was a grocery store owner. And your mom didn't work, but what kind of work did Majid do?
What do you call it? Plates, spoons, kitchenware stuff,
right.
Gift kits, you know, anything you would do. I could send you a picture of him in his store.
In another building? In a nearby building?
In Sheikh Ridwan. That's about a 10-minute cab ride. And that house, that store was bombed. And he owned that building. He owned that the right to use that. It's a municipality thing. But it's you know, he is a hard worker. He loved life. And, you know, I get to know him a lot this summer and had a good time with him. So I'm always grateful for that time we spent. But, you know, we were close. I'm like 42. He's 41. We're, you know, it's a lot. So his house, his store, everything is gone. Livelihood, you know, his kids are killed. And he has two surviving daughters that were married and in Rafah. So that's just one of them. In fact, I was really not too happy about her being rushed to marriage because she's barely like 18 or 19.
Right.
But she literally got married like a week before October 7th.
Hi.
And then she left the family home to be with her hubby. And that saved her life.
Because she was in another location, another town?
She went south, yeah. So that's supposedly the safer zone. And the trauma they live with, the guilt they live with now is too great because not only that they lost their grandparents and their aunt and all that, they've also lost their parents. So family has to step up and compensating for all that emotional trauma that they're dealing with.
And just because I want to make sure I get this accurate, how old was Ali Majid? How old was Ali?
Ali is 7 years old. He's the
7
younger.
Years old. And how and old Omar, was Omar?
Omar is 9 years old.
And Niman? Niman.
Siwar is 14. Then Riman, she is 18. She's a year into college.
Oh, Riman. They have the name spelled Nirman, but it's Riman Majid.
I made that. That's on me.
No, that's okay. I want to make sure I got that. And also, and again, I know this is, it sounds so, it's not that there is not a concern or sympathy, but I want to get these facts out so people see. You know, I mean, you not only lost three homes, you not only lost the town where you were living with your parents lost their home, but you lost your brother, you lost your sister-in-law, you lost the four nephews and nieces. That's terrible.
And the cat,
just devastating.
The cat that Magaz adopted.
And the cat.
they love this cat. They love to play with her. They put her in a safe place, and it wasn't safe enough. And I just asked Ray, like, what threat is a sleeping family representative to somebody in an airstrike to pull the trigger? I feel betrayed. I feel like somebody stabbed me in the back. You come for my family. And I feel like all the lies you're telling and all that, maybe I was like, okay, sympathetic. But I feel right now it's all garbage. This is a vengeful phase that we're seeing, and they just kill, bind, and torture, you know, sort of like everything must die and everyone must be killed. And it's just heartbreaking because my mom was so fortunate. She was in that house the night before, and she went to visit my sister, Fatin. My sister, Fatin, got in a bomb, the window shards flew and hit her head. So she had to have a dozen stitches. And my mom went to visit her. She stayed up later with them. They told her, it's not safe. Stay with us. She usually sleeps in that place. So can you imagine like how she feels? Because she could have also gone with them, God forbid. And, you know, she's diabetic. She's got hypertension. My dad's heart has weak muscle, and they have to bury their children. And this is not the first time this happens. We have an older brother who died in Corona. So it's my dad's trying to be strong, try to be normal, but I know he's not doing well, but he's trying to be strong for everybody else. My mom cries, and when she cries, I cry. I can't take it. It's a lot. Because here's the other thing, Ray. The day before my brother died, he was searching in the neighborhood for drinking water. He ran out. He ran into somebody we know. He promised to bring him water the next day. And he went, and he found him dead.
Wow. And we're talking about, just so to remind everybody, you know, I'm speaking with my guest, Hani El-Medhoun, whose family was in Gaza, his parents, his brother, the family. I think there are 30 relatives that you have that live in the Gaza area. What city did your father and brother and mother live in? What was the name of the town?
Right now, they are all in Beit Lahia. This is north in Gaza.
So currently.
Currently. But historically, from Ashkelon, where now the Russians and the Ukrainians prefer this city because it has cheap food. Can you imagine they find room for Ukrainians who just came last week, but not the people who are actually names are indeed and all that. And that's just heartbreaking, you know?
That is heartbreaking. And they were, so they're in Beit Lahia, was where the homes were that were destroyed and bombed.
Yes.
And where you lost your brother.
So
where are they today? Where are they today? So I mean, terrible tragedy.
They remain in Beit Lahia, but the project side. So this is a area called Project. It has more buildings versus like a farming in Beit Lahia. And they are somewhere, I'm afraid to give the location, so they kill them.
Right.
But it's near a hospital.
So they're still in northern Gaza. They're still in northern Gaza.
Yeah, and I'm trying to get them. There's a number of reasons why they remain in northern Gaza. And then I'm not there because, you know, I try to tell them, go south. You have really legitimate reasons not to leave the south. Because remember, the Israelis are telling, we're coming south. We're coming for you.
Right.
So where do you go? Gaza is a small place. East to west, 10 minutes. You're not talking about a place where you know, it's not a huge place. Anyway.
And then, Hani, you're an American citizen?
Yes.
And what about
Which is bittersweet.
Yeah.
Because you're paying on both sides, right? So you're paying taxes for these bombs, but also you're paying with blood on your Palestinian side. And, you know, it is, my wife is American, my kids are American. But my family are not really up to this point. They're not interested in America because they're, you know, they have their lives. But now this is relevant because I asked the State Department to evacuate them, and they have something about evacuating first degree. Obviously, the priority is for American citizens. I understand that. But they said next of kin is like your first degree relatives. So when they opened that up, I gave them a list of about 26 members of my family, like my brothers, their wives, and things like that. And six people on that list no longer need to travel because they've been killed by genocide.
And they have green cards, though, correct, to the U.S.?
But they're doing it because they're first degree. So the regulation says your first degree and your minor siblings. So meaning if I had a sibling who's 19.
Got it, because, so, and just so I can explain it, because you're an American. Yeah. even though they're not American citizens, once they get the American citizens out, they can get relatives of Americans out. So, and these are first degree relatives of an American.
And then they could look at somebody who has a visa to the U.S. or a green
card.
Got it. So there's different categories. And here is, and it's not really, and I imagine the State Department is working under hard conditions, but also it's very chaotic. The experience, you know, we have a group, WhatsApp group for American Palestinians from Gaza, and we hear these, there's a theme where I write them, get us out of Gaza, my family. They put my name. They know I'm in Annandale. They put my name to travel out of Gaza. I'm like, why? I guess Right. Maybe they're trying to tell the evacuated 800 people, but I am not there, and I'm not the only one this happens to. So I want to salute the people who work hard to evacuate Americans. This is a tough job, but also understand that, you know, people you don't bring out are facing death. And then, you know, Ray, they try to play it like we're sensitive to us looking like we're emptying Gaza. I get that, but is the Palestinian cause more important than the people who stand behind it? Because without people, your cause doesn't matter.
Right. And in this case, I mean, I don't think this needs to be said, but I'm sure that there are people in, you know, the United States and America who have no understanding of the truth or the accuracy of what's happening. They only hear one side. It's a very political side that's driven by support for Israel. And I'm shocked at how little sympathy there is for Palestinians, civilians. Your father had nothing to do with Hamas, did he?
No, none of us have anything to, we're not working with anything. We're not affiliated. We're independent people.
Were they hiding? Was Hamas using their homes and stuff and hiding?
I would love for them to prove that. I gave the coordinates for folks in the U.S. government. I said, show me what they did. I promise. I want to know. That's one of the reasons my family went north, because they said, we know our neighbors. We know the area very well. We're not going to go somewhere where we're not familiar with the geography. That's the exact reason why I stayed there. You go to Khan Yunis. I love the people there, but you don't know what's going on. The Israelis targeting you. You're at disadvantage. I know our family. We know our neighbors. My brother, just the faith is, you know, as big as the ocean, and he just wanted to stay. And sadly, we buried him a few days ago.
And I know it's tough. Now, when was the last time you were in Gaza?
We left Gaza August 10th. We spent the summer there with my kids. And it is not easy, because I look at WhatsApp and I try to message my dead brother, because I think, maybe he's still around. Maybe he's sold, you know. I look at the locations we used to share, and then I joke with him. I said, you're either home or at the store. You're not the kind who's going to go to an exciting place. So actually, I showed him how to use the location share, and he thought it's the greatest thing. And here's another thing that got me, Ray. In the summer, he asked me, hey, can you help me get in Google Map for his store? And I did. I put his picture, the name of his store. If you go to his store, you see his picture standing there, and that's it. The store is gone and the owner is gone. And, you know, we like to be resilient and strong people, but I frankly cry a lot with this, because grief is sneaky. And I'm sure if you've lived long, you know how it sneaks up on you, and you can't control it, because we're human beings. We have value. Sadly, the folks with the power to protect our lives, they are not interested in seeing that. Instead, they distract. And I say this as a Palestinian American, not anything to do with any of the great agencies I work with. They give bombs and they give you a can of tuna. So like, hey, we're going to do whatever we have to, but you could have a can of tuna before you get killed. And that's the frustrating part. I mean, people tell you we need a freaking sustainable and durable ceasefire. And they say, oh, we're going to bring in more aid. We're going to bring more fuel. It's the way of people. I don't know. How would you describe that, Ray? You have a way of, like, you know, you're trying to speak from both sides of the mouth or something.
Well, you want to be fair. You want to be accurate. I mean, your family had nothing to do with October 7th. Your family 100%. Had nothing to do with any violence in the past. Your family had nothing to do with this other than running some stores, a grocery store, a store that sells clothing and items, you know, retail mm-hmm. items, and in three buildings that were in an area that had nothing to do with Hamas whatsoever.
And even like, let's think about this. Like, I know like Ali and all these guys and my brother have nothing to do with this, whatever, October 7th. We're just the grass of the land. Whenever two elephants fight, we get screwed anyway. Here is something that's really shocking to me. Our first house in Beit Lahia was bombed by an F-16. And it made such a big hole in the ground. And here's what the story my family told me. So our neighbors have an open land, and they keep four sheep on the floor. So the plane saw some movement, and they thought, oh my gosh, and they blew up the sheep. One of them got killed. Maybe $1 million bomb to kill one sheep. They're thinking they're killing some, you know. And
this is the first time. When was that?
This is in the second or third week of, because the family couldn't go to Beit Lahia.
After October 7th, about a week or two afterwards.
They made a hole in the ground, and they were going after sheep. There's four sheep that were in the land next to us. They thought they're like some fighters or something like that. They destroyed our building. I could send you pictures if you like. And they killed one sheep.
And they were just bombing whatever they could see, any movement.
Oh, yeah. It's by Israeli words, they've said that. They said the focus is not in accuracy, but on damage. They've said worst thing on live TV and American TV, and somebody called for genocide in one of those big networks I will not name here. And the anchor had no pushback. He was fine with it. You see, them talking about the Israeli detainees or hostages, I'm so happy. They're relieved. If I have any way of influencing that, I'm going to release all of them. But here is the reality. Have you seen them humanize any Palestinian, even a kid,
no.
A Palestinian kid who's 13? Oh, no. Why? Why is this, you know?
I was on a radio show talking with somebody, and I said, you know, they are releasing hostages for quote-unquote prisoners. I said, but most of these prisoners are not prisoners. They're arrested under administrative detention, which means that they're not brought to trial. They're not charged. They're put in there as young kids. And he said, well, they're prisoners, so they're terrorists. I said, no, you don't know anything about them. All you know about is the hostages. You know nothing about the victims on the Palestinian side. Honey, I know that, you know, you're very Americanized. You understand the system. You work for an agency that helps people. And I'm not surprised that you would say that you have sympathy and empathy for any of the Israelis who were killed too, because you're not a violent person. Absolutely.
We're humans.
What do you think is wrong with this situation? I mean, why don't Americans recognize the empathy and the tragedy of what's happening to other, so many, 15,000 civilians have been killed and thousands more have been displaced. Why? What is it about this situation that makes Americans and the public so unsympathetic to that?
I mean, there's a combination of things. I could see the media stealing the story in a different way. There's a pushback. You have an anchor say something about Palestine, that their bosses will get a million letter and a million advertisement boycott and all that. It is very expensive for folks to speak about Palestine. I just spoke to a physician, a friend of mine, a gifted physician, in Michigan, who was terminated from her job for something that she said about Palestine, or maybe not even with Palestine, but they assumed it's about Palestine. So that's one. But really, like, I want to really bring it back to talk about Ali, like, you know, and Omar.
Yes.
You know, like, play soccer. Yes. Right? He's a kid. I'm not, you know, want to make political statements about, like, Omar plays soccer. We got him the soccer gear. I don't know if you saw that picture. He's so proud of it, showing off with his friends in Gaza. And then Siwar, she's a girl playing basketball. Amazing. She just won the cup. She took home the trophy in August, middle of August. And we're happy and proud of her. Her dad is always supportive, you know, and he's very tender. He's a very tender guy. He's always like, you know, if somebody says, hey, I don't have money, like, you know, the people you see in the metro, like, hey, I'm out of money, he would give him money. That's the kind of person he is. And he did nothing. I dare anybody to tell me, like, oh, he did this. Like, there is nothing. I am so confident. I shared the coordinates of the house that was bombed by Israel with somebody who may, like, okay, maybe there's always lies. You've seen the calendar in the Shifa hospital, right? Come on. They don't need. And guess what? The tunnel they talked about at Shifa, the Israelis tell you, like, we dug this tunnel. This is not a Hamas tunnel. Anyway, sorry, I'm agitated, Ray.
No, listen, I think people understand that you have a tremendous loss, a brother, his entire family, and the future of the rest of your family is in jeopardy. I mean, as far as you know, they're still trying to duck and dodge from the tragedy. They're living on the street. You know, there's no food, there's no water, there's no electricity. You know, their situation has to be very disconcerting and worrisome for you. Annie, listen, first of all, I want to say again, my condolences and my total sympathy for you, your family, and what's happened to you. And I hope the rest of your family, that nothing happens to them. That's the most important thing, I think. Thank you for sharing this story with us.
I appreciate you having me. I pray you're right. I hope this is the last of sad events coming out from Gaza. I want to believe it so much. My heart tells me believe it. My mind tells me, hold on a minute, because they're always going to find a way to hurt more people, unfortunately.
All right. Thank you, Annie.
So we're going to take a quick break here at Radio Ballady at WNZK AM 690. And when we come back, we'll continue the radio show. I'm Ray Hanania. We'll be right back right after these messages. Thank you for listening to our show this morning. You can get more information on my writings and the show by visiting hanania.com. And please, I encourage you to read my columns and my news reports at arabnews.com. I'm Ray Hanania. Have a great week. We will talk to you next week, the second Friday of the month, as I guest host again, Radio Ballady. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.